morning. Let's open with a word of prayer. Now, Father, we do come before you in prayer that you will guide our thoughts and minds in such a way that as we are prompted and caused to think, those thoughts will be pleasing in your sight. We pray this in the name of Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. I want to welcome you to this panel discussion that is occasioned by the 25th anniversary, the publication of Neil Postman's book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. I remember very well when I first came across this book. It was the very week that it had been published and came out, and I picked it up because I was intrigued by its title and also by its subtitle, Public Discourse in the Age of Show Business. Neil Postman was a writer, social commentator, and a professor at New York University, where he taught communications. I began to read this book the night that I had picked it up, and I read it through in one reading and knew that I had read a book that would cause me to think for many years to come. Neil Postman's specialization is communications. He understood basic transformations that were taking place there in the last part of the 20th century. 25 years ago, in the year 1985, he perceived that something basic was happening in American culture, and that, to put it in his own words, we were in danger of amusing ourselves to death by transforming every significant issue into a matter of cultural amusement. He had some very specific criticisms. Some of them, from the vantage point of 25 years, seem a bit anachronistic. Others seem very, very pointed. It seemed appropriate, 25 years after the publication of Amusing Ourselves to Death, to go back and ask the question, what does it mean then and what does it mean now? I'm joined here in this panel discussion by four who are very capable of joining into this conversation. Owen Strand is instructor of Christian theology and church history at Boyce College. He served as managing director of the Carl F. H. Henry Center for Theological Understanding and was the founding associate director of the Jonathan Edwards Center at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. Timothy Paul Jones has been associate professor of leadership and church ministry since 2007. Additionally, he's the editor of the recently launched Journal of Family Ministry. He is the Family Ministry Coordinator and Children's Ministry Coordinator here at Southern Seminary. Mark T. Coppinger has served as Professor of Christian Apologetics since 2004. In addition to teaching at Southern Seminary, Dr. Coppinger is pastor of Evanston, Illinois Baptist Church. He is also the BCM Director of Northwestern University. He's the managing editor of the online Kairos Journal. Bruce Kiesling has been Associate Vice President of Academic Resources and Seminary Librarian at Southern Seminary since 2002. Prior to this, he served as the Associate Librarian from 1998. He also serves as an elder at Third Avenue Baptist Church here in Louisville, Kentucky. Gentlemen, when I picked up the book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, I knew I was picking up a book that told me some things I already knew and already intuited, and put it into a conceptual framework. I also knew that I was reading a book that I thought would incite some cultural conversation. But I have to tell you, looking back 25 years ago, and by the way, I wrote one of the first reviews of this book. I wrote it for Preaching Magazine because I thought preachers ought to read this book. I had no idea it would have the traction that it has, such that we'd be talking about it now, two decades and more later. Does that make sense to you? Do you have the same sense that this book had a rather surprising staying power?
No, I'm not. I mean, it's of course the media have exploded, and when I was reading it, I was struck about something we did for the Bertice Berry show, and I hadn't read the book all the way through, but I don't know if you remember, we had a study of the number of lost people in America, the concentration of people in America, and we had a map out of HMB at the time showing dark red in lost areas and light yellow in others. And as we went on this show, the Southern Baptists were on the griddle, and I was in a sense the villain that day because our group said that a lot of Americans are lost. So I flew up there. We had an atheist, we had a Loyola professor, we had a professional atheist, we had a black Pentecostal preacher, and a Council of Christians and Jews rabbi. And so the show starts with the camera on me, and it said, "This man says half of America's going to hell." That's how the thing began. And we were prepping for this thing, and we were in the green room, and having a good time meeting one another. And the production assistant ran in and grabbed me and the Pentecostal preacher and said, "You've got to get out of here." And she took us away from the atheist and the rabbi and essentially the liberal Catholic into another room. We said, "What's the problem?" She says, "The last thing we want is for you to become friends with these people, because then it's just going to be warm and collegial. We want conflict." And then Bertice called us back together and says, "Okay, here's the deal. This is the worst possible thing that could happen. If I ask a question and you answer, interrupt each other, interrupt me, jump in, so forth. It's going to be, you've got to make this a fight." And as I'm reading this, I thought, yeah, that's what we've got here. It's got to be entertainment. It's not going to be thoughtful, deliberate, reflective stuff. Yeah. And he's nailed it. And that's the way it is today.
Timothy?
From coming to this, I read it first in the late 1990s, if I remember correctly, and then read it again for this. And to me, his contrast between Huxley's vision and then Orwell's vision is really helpful. His idea that there would come a time when not only are we, in our discussions, in all of that, it's not that we are banned from reading, it's that we don't desire to read. That displacement of reading, I think, is really crucial, is something that we see that just bears constant repetition, consideration of the fact of that importance of that, and how he points out that the typographic culture, what type of culture that is, and contrasts and compares that. It's really helpful things coming from when he wrote this book. I was wondering why my mom and dad wouldn't let me watch everything I wanted on television. That was when he wrote that, and I was unaware completely of this book. And looking back, I think I see some wisdom in what they were doing and saying about reading rather than doing this. And in our culture, in which television has in some ways become this big as opposed to this big, that there's a new challenge worth looking at the book again, because of the fact that at one time television could draw you together into community. And I think in addition to what he points out, it individualizes and atomizes even more than it perhaps did then, because of the fact it's in your hand even opposed to in your living room.
Right, which he could not foresee, and that's an interesting part of our future discussion here, is kind of updating Neil Postman for the digital age, but we're not there yet. Let's go back to 1985. Owen, you were not reading in 1985, but had you been reading in 1985 and you read this book, what would you have thought of it?
I think I would have thought that it accurately captured the spirit of the age, that I grew up on Sesame Street and other programs. My parents limited my TV watching as well, so I'm very thankful for that today, especially reading a book like this. And yet, I would have found, I think, that the book captured these inherent weaknesses in television-based education, for example. You can communicate concepts quickly and simply on television, and there is some good to that. And by the way, you can communicate them in long form on the History Channel or something like that, but how many people watch the History Channel? And when you're going to a place like Sesame Street, you're getting these quick concepts, but you're not going deep in your education. So Postman, I think, exposes that television can perhaps be an aid to traditional education, but we do ourselves a major disservice, I think, if we allow it to usurp traditional education, which is much more suited to long-form communication, deep thinking, cultivation of ideas.
Bruce Kiesling, this book has to encourage you, because it should lean right into your prejudices. You are a librarian, after all. Books are so much a part of your life. Neil Postman wrote a book to suggest that entertainment culture is absolutely devoid of any useful means of communicating big ideas. I'm just assuming you're rather prejudiced to agree with him.
Well, just to keep things interesting, I'll provide a slightly different response. Librarians also love to be cranks. And we love nothing better than finding another crank. And Neil Postman is rather cranky. It is a period piece written in 1985. We as a country loved feeling bad about ourselves from 1970 till 1980. And I think he makes some valid points, but I think he overstated kind of this, where was this golden age of literacy? As a librarian, when I was in library school, I read articles written by librarians in 1930 who were complaining about the fact that people weren't reading.
Yes.
They weren't reading. They were out playing baseball. They were going to movies. They were amusing themselves to death pre-television. So, yes, there are many things that Postman says that resonate as a librarian, but I don't think we help the discussion along if we just wallow in our schadenfreude, just feeling bad about ourselves. Let's really identify where was literacy at its best. What can we do to promote that? Yada, yada, yada.
Not to mention our Weltschmerz.
I had to use a German word.
I'm with you. I think that he swings so far to the other side, and you think, have you ever found a work of art that you like? I mean, were you ever moved by a movie?
But there's something else going on here, and this is why I was hoping that first question would put enough out that there'd be something really to go after here. Why did Neil Postman write this book? All right? In 1985, it was clear why Neil Postman wrote this book. In the year 2000, looking back, it is not so clear. And in 2010, even less clear. Neil Postman wrote this book to explain to liberal intelligentsia, that hometown culture, how could Ronald Reagan be elected president of the United States? Yeah. An actor, a movie theater figure, a person of little intellectual consequence to the intellectual classes. How could this happen? Right. And so there's a political agenda here as well, but there's also a sense in 1985 that popular culture was going astray. And the background of that has to do with the fact that the producers of culture had a pretty tight control on things throughout most of the 20th century, at least in terms of the developing technology of television, for instance. I don't think that Neil Postman had Enora Murrow in mind when he wrote this. He instead has in mind the democratization of this kind of media, and so there's a lot going on here. But I want to go to his thesis statement, because when I first picked up this book, I thought, you know, I know why he wrote the book. I've got it. This is a part of the cultural conversation of the left in the 1980s. But you know, as a Christian and as one concerned for preaching, there's actually a lot in here that demands our attention, because a lot of his indictment or diagnosis of the mind, the cluttered amusement, entertainment, satiated mind was I thought very, very interesting. In his thesis statement, he talks about, well, why more or less he titled the book this way. He says, our politics, religion, news, athletics, education, and commerce have been transformed into congenial adjuncts of show business, largely without protest or even much popular notice. The result is that we are a people on the verge of amusing ourselves to death. Now, the reason why I think that has an immediate cogency is because when we turn on the news in terms of television news, and I think the situation, if anything, is worse now in terms of the cable news networks, we know that what's really going on there is entertainment. It's packaged as news, but it's really entertainment. I mean, he had something here, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I'm having an Aristotelian moment here in that every virtue is in between two extremes, that...
So talk courage. About the virtues first.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the virtue is, I kind of tied in with the Bertice Berry thing, but I mean, I can give any number of examples where it's just shallow, ridiculous. You go look at Entertainment Tonight, and they'll say, you know, someone had, this is his seventh wife, and they go, da-da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da, and by the way, you know, this film projector blew up, da-da-da-da-da-da, and everything is even. You know, it's just this leveling of insanity. And so there's this superficiality. On the other hand, I think he's such a stiff and such an elitist, and it's like, look, it's good to have like raisins and cranberries and almond chips in the oatmeal, and he is, you're exactly right, he's dissing the herd, but there are some points about, and I'll say this too, there are other things in the media. Liz Trotta talks about this in a book on the news, where she says they feel like they have to represent everything as the middle ground. You have to hear this guy and that guy. So if it's a political thing, you hear from the Democrat, you hear from the Republican. But then after a while, it's like, all right, what about incest? Pro-incest, anti-incest? It's as though you're always trying to find the middle, and that starts to shape our understanding of reality, that you never want to be on the extreme. It's always the middle. Like, so what's the moderate view of adultery? I mean, the media does shape our thinking. That's a good point he makes, but he's so dismissive of I think, parable and also concision and just artistic pace. And the media can surely teach us how to package something well and to be engaging. Jesus was engaging.
You know, you've had your time, and now this.
I tried to get it into a soundbite, but I knew it wouldn't work.
Which is one of Postman's points. You know, you go from something, and once the topic gets interesting on television, it gets cut off.
Yeah.
And then you go to a dog food commercial, and which we do not have queued up. So we're going to go to another panelist here in order to say, the problem with reading this book is if it's kind of like Lily Tomlin. My favorite quote from Lily Tomlin, and I don't have a long list of favorite quotes, but the one quote that always comes to my mind is she says, "I'm trying to be cynical, but it's hard to keep up." And you know, when you read this, you realize, you know, this really is onto something. And before we try to transcend the argument, I think we ought to deal with his argument. I mean, he really is talking about, for one thing, a very limited attention span, isn't he, Timothy?
I think that his whole section on now this,
yeah.
That and the fact that it introduces juxtapositions that are unnatural, that you have different things placed in sequence with one another, that don't fit together, and that
it's a great leveling.
Yeah, everything becomes the democratization of knowledge has also become a democratization in some sense, a leveling of the import of certain things, and so things that are completely fluff are placed in immediate sequence with that which is weighty, that which is devastating to a family's life, is placed right after a dishwashing liquid commercial or whatever it may be. All these things placed, and I think that's part of his critique that he's making, that he has a point that with the democratization of media also comes a democratization of our ideas of, which isn't really a democratization, but a leveling of those ideas in a way that is both unnatural, and not only that, it is harmful to the way in which we speak. He speaks of that television has an inherent bias toward communicating things in certain ways. And in the midst of that, I think that's what he's saying, that it has that bias toward placing things together in ways that are not helpful for our intellect, for ourselves, for our capacity to think critically about things.
Owen, Neil Postman talked about a television-based epistemology.
Yes.
Is there such a thing?
Is this a good thing?
Is there such a thing?
Yes. I think that there is. There's a sense in which people who have learned from the television primarily think that they have to be entertained. They think that they have to be learning visually, constantly. They need to be stimulated at all times or else they're going to lose their attention span. You know, I think there is a cogency here. There's a force to Postman's argument that we could lose, and that is that it's not so much that people won't focus on art or culture or entertainment or political discourse or that sort of thing. They will. They will focus on football for an entire Saturday. They'll watch 14 hours of it. Their attention span will be locked in. But I think Postman's critique is that invite them to a sermon that is 45 minutes long and see how long they hold up. See how long they last. That's where I think Postman's argument really lands.
There's another part of his television-based epistemology that I found very interesting, and it's not only in this book but in some of his other writings, in which he suggests that an entire generation, and now there would be multiple generations of Americans, believe that if they can't see it, it didn't happen. Hmm. And you know, once we get accustomed to seeing the news, and if a volcano erupts, there it is. You know, if a plane crashes, there it is. There's a sense in which generations since the arrival of the televisual believe you've got to be able to see it in order to have any kind of grasp of it. Bruce, I'd have to ask you a basic question here. Is print culture superior to visual culture as a means of transmitting thought?
No.
It's not?
Well, I think the text is. And so I guess I would say I don't want to say that it has to be on that paper in that book. I think text, words generally in whatever form they're in, Visual culture, though, is communicating. And I guess...
But, you know, I have to say, you're shocking me a little bit here, because we do not have a collection of prints we call a library. We have a collection of books.
Right. Well, I think... I guess what I'm reacting to Postman. I think that there are gains and losses in each form of communicating. So I would say, as long as you're not... Are you asking me, can I read it on my Kindle? Yes. I would love to read it on my Kindle. I just want to make sure that I'm... Am I reacting to your...
No, I think you're being overly cranky, frankly. Okay. It's just... I meant it just as I ask it. You know, it is not a print culture superior to a visual culture in communicating ideas. It has to be.
A textual culture.
Well, but you're making a distinction here that I don't think is very helpful to us, frankly,
okay.
Because people are not just going around saying I'm carrying a text. You know, they're carrying newspapers, magazines, books, and all the rest.
Okay, well, then first, I'll...
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Well, a language culture that is a language that is readable. The culture of reading is the point here.
I mean, I've got artists in my church, and I resonated when he's quoting Susan Sontag, I think, about photographs and the like. I love art, and I teach aesthetics, and we have art all over our church. But the thing about the arts is it doesn't have a bare proposition. I mean, it's an impression, and it's striking, and so forth. This has always amused me about artists. If there's something transgressive or shocking, then and you attack me, say no, I'm not saying anything. This is just art. It's an expression. I just put it out there. And so they disclaim any kind of responsibility for a statement. But then if you praise their statement, like, man, that is really deep. That was heavy. You brought it. Well, thank you very much. It's like you can't lose in the arts. And to put it in a proposition, you put it out there, and that has an edge. I think there's no substitute for the preached word, and not just the visual word.
Particularly for us Christians, for us as theologically minded people, that we always lean in the direction of the written, the propositional.
Yeah.
I think that the art in churches, for the most part, it has pointed toward a text. That is, when you have the stained glass or when you have the painting, it points toward a text. And I think that's because from the early stages, as Christians, we are not people who are engaging in experience seeking an image. We are engaged in faith seeking understanding. And I think that that's very crucial for us, particularly in theologically, in a theological institution. Does what we do image-wise point toward a proposition, toward a truth that is statable, or are we trying simply to create an image? And I think it's a danger we are up against in our culture constantly.
He calls it epistemology. I want to call it doxasticology instead of doxology, just a more curious word. But it has to do with the generation of belief. And I think he does say important things about how you have to package something for people to buy it. I think in the university today, in many cases, you have to put it on PowerPoint for them to think it's real. You know, it's got to have bullets, and you know, you can do some note-taking and then cough it back. In philosophy, you have to chism. Chisming is named for Roderick Chisholm. You have to put very careful propositions with prime, two prime, and so forth for them to receive it in the APA. He's saying to package it today to get people to buy it, you have to put it in a certain way, and I think that's a true thing. But it has to do with the generation of belief, I think.
Two recent studies came out in the last few weeks. One came out last week saying that less than half of all American eighth grade boys can read at anything like grade level. And they are graduating from high school, when they do graduate, still far below grade level. And many of them will not read a book for the rest of their lives. And so they're really not even connected to print culture anymore. Now, there is a measurable fall off then in reading, because their grandfathers, in all likelihood, were readers. For instance, even among African Americans in the United States, the period of 20 years after the Civil War was a period that went from very low literacy to almost universal literacy. So there has been something lost just across the whole spectrum of American culture, where the topics of our conversation these days are very rarely books, illustration. Very few people are talking about President George W. Bush's memoir, Decision Points, that was released on Tuesday. They're talking about the news coverage about it, and they're talking about President Bush's interview with Matt Lauer on NBC. It seems like we're still there. And it's the amusing anecdote out of that that becomes the topic of cultural conversation.
Yeah. Can I throw in? I think everybody on this panel is a reader, loves reading. An inveterate reader, I'm guessing. You know, you can't stop reading to some extent. Which
makes us feel superior.
Sure.
Because it is a superior way of communicating ideas. Yes.
Yeah. I'm not going to complete that sentence, but you can. But we are the vast exception and the shrinking exception. I mean, the vast majority of youth, as you're talking about now, are on Facebook 8 hours a day. They're on Twitter. They're texting. Postman's critique, I think, lands on that point. We can say, you know, he doesn't leave enough place for the arts, and I think that's true. You know, his critique is not always apt, but in terms of the broad swath of his argument that Americans are not able to think critically for long periods of time, and that is based in a lack of ability to concentrate and be disciplined, I think he's right on. I mean, I think people in here, people watching today, are going to struggle to pay attention to this panel while they're watching it because of the distractedness that is everywhere around us.
One of the interesting aspects of a book like this is that it has to do at least two things. First of all, it has to declare a crisis, otherwise there's no need to buy the book. That's the urgency. And then the second thing is it has to have a certain historical narrative. There has to be a past, present, and future. Things were better in the past, things are troubled now, and things could be different in the future. I think as tempting as it is to just dismiss that as kind of the pattern of such a book, when he makes a very sophisticated argument about the shift from an age of exposition to an age of show business, I have a hard time believing he's not right, just in terms of popular culture. There once was a time, and there really was once a time, when presidential candidates debated rather than just exchanging sound bites. We know that because we can go back and find the film and we can go back and read the transcripts. So what happened to the American mind somewhere on the way to the end of the 20th century that we somehow exchanged exposition in public discourse for entertainment? What happened?
I think it's some of those same things that the writer of Proverbs talks about. We are inherently inclined to find the easy way of doing things. You know, there's a sloth, there's a laziness that we need to seek to overcome. It is easy. Sound bites make life easy.
Yeah, I mean, I think
that's a sound bite.
And that's a
sound bite. Sound bites make things easy. Exactly. Thank you. That's perfect. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of gotcha journalism too. I think that. You take one, if you just say something like strategery or just mispronounce one word or whatever, they're all over you, they beat you to death. And so then finally you think, I've got to get a manager, we've got to script this thing, you have to put it on the teleprompter. I think we're terrified of that fox paw, you know, where it's all over the place. And I think that's part of it. One thing, by the way, did strike me. I read this in Weekly Standard, that if you look at the pundits on television, they're overwhelmingly Catholic and Jewish. You have Sean Hannity and Limbaugh and O'Reilly and Cato Byrne and John O'Sullivan, Catholic. Then you have Michael Medved and Crystal and on and on and on, and Mona Charon. Evangelicals, Cal Thomas, you know, maybe, kind of Fred Barnes, perhaps. I think we should bear some of the blame. We are not a discursive subculture in a way. We're not very good at argument, and we haven't had the Jesuits or the Jewish rabbi pounding us enough, and so we become, I think, kind of weak and insipid, where we can pontificate and then take notes or then just blast back, but not be discursive. So I think that we are not only victims or products of the age, but we're the contributors, in a sense.
Well, Neil Postman says we are because he's watched religious television.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think in one of the points in the book that certainly kind of, well, hurts a little because we know how true it is when he, as an outsider, watches television evangelists and says, this is show business. Take it from someone who knows show business, that's show business. Mm. That hurts. Yeah. It's true.
Yes. the medium, I mean, he points out that the medium is biased toward a particular type of message. And I find it interesting, too, that if, and I think proving the demonstrating the point that there has been an authentic shift in what's happened, you go back to the 19th century, and those who were even most focused on cultivating an inner life and feelings, the American transcendentalists, the romantists, all of that era there, they're still communicating it through rational discourse. And I think that's a really important thing to notice in that, whereas we could transfer that forward, those who would be perhaps in that category now are not necessarily engaging in it through rational discourse, but rather through entertainment, are conveying through the talk shows and through everything like that. That's how they're conveying this. There's an authentic shift over a century that I think we can see even in persons who might even be like-minded in their approach.
Owen, in that section in which he writes about the television evangelists, he suggests that this shift in the larger culture from exposition to show business has produced a mode of preaching in which everything has to be positive. There have to be interrupted, punctuated moments of amusement, and it appears that God's greatest desire for us is that we be happy and amused. Now, I wince when I read that because I don't think it's limited to the television evangelists. I think in some sense the larger preaching culture has been greatly affected by the very kinds of changes and seductions he's talking about.
Absolutely. Again, it's very easy for most of us to watch a movie that we like, to watch Avatar, to watch Harry Potter, I don't know, you know, what the film would be, The Social Network. We can focus very well on those things. We are engrossed. We can go back and blog about it. We can think about it and talk about it. But if you want to talk about a 50-minute sermon on Job, we struggle mightily to focus on a sermon of that length if it's not punctuated by jokes and entertainment and constant stories and that sort of thing. Now, many of us would like a rich blend of these kind of things. We wouldn't just want sort of one proposition after another laid out as boringly as possible. And there is preaching out there that may fit that category. But at the same time, I think that we're way off on the far end of the entertainment category. And if you browse God TV or many of the Christian networks today, not every preacher falls into that category, but many of them do. They look cool. The audience looks affluent and comfortable. And you hear lots of messages about winning and fulfillment and prosperity and these things. You don't exactly come across sinners in the hands of an angry God at 8 o'clock on a Thursday night on many of these Christian networks.
Well, and if you come across sinners in the hands of an angry God, you come across it as a trope. Mm-hmm. As an illustration of what once was inflicted on people,
yeah, exactly.
That we are now liberated no longer to hear. One of the other points that Postman makes is, I think, something that is only magnified by a quantum significance in the digital age. It makes the point that we have an epistemology of choice. We no longer have to listen to this authority because this is the only show in town.
Yeah.
We no longer have to read this book because otherwise we really can't enter into the cultural conversation in a meaningful way. If we don't like this channel, we can move on. A recent study that was done by the advertising world came to the conclusion that people will give about 30 seconds maximum to a channel selection before deciding they're going to stay there or go on. That's it. And in some cases, and by the way, there's a difference between men and women. Men, it's down to about 11 seconds. That's about it. No, it doesn't look interesting. We go on. And then you wonder, at the end of the day, how do you talk meaningfully about big ideas, matters of eternal consequence, with people who really want to put a remote control in your face and go just to move you on?
It's encouraging, I think, both reading, which he would affirm, but also the next step beyond that, which is reflection. You have to, whatever form it's in, you know, a printed book, newspaper, Dan Dumas reading his Kindle, whatever it is, whatever source it is, the next thing beyond that is reflection. Thinking about what you've read and then asking the question, how shall we then live? What do we do with what we have just heard? And that, to me, it's not just print, and it's not just reading, but it is actually encouraging a culture that expects people to think in a meaningful way about what you've read.
And there's a tremendous opportunity here for preaching that is really rich and good and gripping. And that is why this whole neo-reform movement has caught like wildfire, because there's such good preaching that grips young hearers and other hearers as well, and that has really spurred the movement. Many of them come to this chapel, and many of us read their books and that sort of thing, figures like John Piper. When you hear that preaching, you can't help but be gripped. It's better than the TV preaching.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it goes to seed when you think that the longer the sermon and the fewer the illustrations, the better. I mean, some people take it the wrong way. It's sort of right. Like, if I'm going to be Rick Warren, I'll get a Hawaiian shirt, you know, and go to Orange County. You can take things too far, but I think you're exactly right. There's a richness to it. I, as a preacher, feel as though I'm competing with the theater in a way. Like, what's playing today? Is it good? And, you know, and they don't have any attachment to the theater. They just drop in and out, and so there's a lot of that. Let me say a good word about the propositions presented on television. You not only have some content, but, you know, speech and conviction is incarnated. And to me, it's useful to see Maureen Dowd, not only read Maureen Dowd, but just to see her fingernails on the blackboard personality. And if someone is reading a Dr. Moeller column, it's good for them to see you on Larry King or whatever, because you think, oh, this guy's, you know, homophobic, or he's this or this or this. And then you think, wow, you know, he's actually clothed in his right mind. So I think it's important to have the body there as well. Television does that.
I think it's a helpful word. You know, we live in a world in which it's impossible to be a purist, even if you're Neil Postman, because his book was discussed on television.
Yeah,
you end up realizing that this is where we are. We're an institution that is about the transmission of the most serious ideas we could imagine or conceive. Matters of not only temporal but eternal consequence. We are an institution that is unapologetically committed to the text, of Scripture, first of all, and then to a world of textual meaning that is encapsulated not in a library, but in the books that we carry around, that we put in our libraries and in our studies, and that we, yes, even upload onto our Kindles and iPads. But at the same time, we've got a website. The digital world just exaggerates everything that Neil Postman was talking about. The attention span on the web is less than the attention span, we're now told, that was true in the televisual world. And it's because we have a missiological concern here. Do we just want to look hip? Well, we don't want to be outside the cultural conversation, but it's for missiological purposes. There's a sense in which Christians need to be aware of the dangers and limitations of all of these various forms of media. But I think without apology, we're there trying to do something that's different. To be pointed, I and others are criticized for going on to these television programs in order to speak about Christian truth. And to be honest, there are many I would not go on to appear because I do not think there could be any legitimate discourse. But I have to say, there have been moments, I think, of rare and even privileged discourse that has taken place in that kind of context. So I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. I just want to come back and say, you know, it's really good for me that I have this kind of argument in my mind as I go on to that set.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think of types of Scripture. I mean, you have narrative and you have genealogies and you have proverbs and all kinds of things, poetry and apocalyptic stuff. And I think that the Bible is rich for that. And it's almost as saying, I just wish everything were like narrative, I mean, historical right. narrative or whatever, and say, enjoy the range of idioms, so to speak. But yeah, he does. I remember when I worked at the SBC in the PR office, we would get calls from the religion writers, and they had limited budget, so they didn't know whether to go to the Assembly of God convention this year or to the Presbyterians or the Baptists. And so they would say, okay, what's going on down there in Orlando? And I'd say, well, we're going to have a evangelistic thrust, and we're going to go around the community. Yeah, okay, fine. And then we're going to have a prayer for spiritual awakening evening. We'll suspend everything and just get before God. Yeah, fine. Oh, and there's going to be a fist fight on aisle 12. Wait, slow down. You know, like that. They love right. conflict, and so even though that's a tiny part.
If it bleeds, it leads.
If it bleeds, it leads. Yeah, and so yeah. if if you just let them have their way, we really, it is a moronic enterprise, I have to say, in many respects.
Timothy, I want to ask you a question. Can you seduce people who are shaped by the televisual epistemology, people who are now shaped by the digital mind? Can you seduce digital natives into reading books?
I think we can. I think it takes time. I think we have to, and this is from having preached for several years in a culture, in a church that was not a reading church at all. I attempted to get them to read what I thought were very simple, straightforward theological things, but it was hard to do that. And I resorted to using a lot of visual things, but I tried to keep in mind, and I can't say I did it perfectly in every instance, that how do I use the visual media to aim them toward a proposition? That, in other words, the visual media and the experience and whatever comes from that does not become the end in and of itself, but to aim them toward text, toward proposition, toward the ideas, toward the thoughts. I think it is possible. I think it is very difficult to do, because the risk we run is that what we give them a little of to bring them in becomes what they want more of to keep them coming. And that's the risk that we run, and it is a very real risk when we do that, that we give them a little bit of that to get them in, but then they want more of that to keep them coming. But I think it is possible to utilize the visual media for the purpose of aiming them toward propositional, toward reasonable, and that is not to say reasonable in the sense of excluding the emotional. It is rather to say the capacity for rational discourse about ideas that really matter and seeing them of eternal import.
Owen, you read this book from the vantage point of one who, in 1985, was not yet a part of the problem or the solution. But when you think of how your generation and those behind you have walked into a universe of communication and meaning, do you feel like Neil Postman and the whole idea of amusing ourselves to death was pointing to something that's merely a period piece back in 1985, or do you think the same temptations and the same reductions and the same kind of entertainment appetite marks the contemporary moment?
Yeah, there's an irony here, because I think I'm the youngest panelist, and I think I'm the crankiest, maybe. But I would say that Postman's critique is mild when you take into account the internet age. Mm-hmm. The internet age is much more interactive, much more engrossing in terms of drawing your attention in a thousand different directions than was the television age. If you watch television from the 1980s today, if you watch a movie, it's hard to watch, for at least for me, mm-hmm. because the cuts are so slow, the shots are so long. Movies more recently today will have 1 second cuts, 2 second cuts, 5 second scenes, 10 second scenes, and that creates a way of watching that you cannot undo. I mean, if you look at struggles with young men, for example, today, they are engrossed in digital media. They are watching sports and TV, and it is going to be near impossible to pull them out of that back into reading Plato and Aristotle and Christian great books.
Well, I think impossible. We probably set it up falsely, though, if we insinuate that what we really want them to do is to read Plato and Aristotle. That their grandfathers didn't do that either. I mean, in terms of formal education, yes, but I mean, frankly, just being able to read the New York Times would be an achievement. And to consider the kinds of arguments and issues that we would encounter in just even the daily newspaper, or then to move on to reading a book that wouldn't even have to be a major work of philosophy or anything right. That's in kind of the canon of Western civilization, but just a book that would be something other than a cartoon book, manga, or whatever. I think going to be a challenge, but I think it's going to be a necessary challenge, because I don't think we're going to find the leaders of our churches in the future. I don't think we're going to find those who are going to have the positions of teaching authority and those who are going to be the elders of our churches and have that responsibility. Those who are going to be the spiritual counselors and and guides of our churches, I don't think they're going to be very helpful or faithful if they are merely stuck in that digital domain, merely stuck in the televisual. The Apostle Paul said to Timothy, bring the books and the parchments. I think there's something there other than antiquarian reference.
I think a lot of it's infectious. I remember we were at meetings occasionally where as soon as the meeting broke up, like at ACE, you head for a bookstore, and I'm tagging along, and we're all over the place, and we'll come out of that bookstore with books under our arms, and you talk books. And I think that if we talk books and we're infectious with our enthusiasm, like, oh, look what I just got, and here's this, and, oh, did you see the part here? I think it's catching. I think we're around a lot of people who don't love books, and so there's nothing to catch. But I think they can catch it from you. I did think about short. If you want to see short TV, I love to watch Hispanic television in Chicago with Telemundo and, you know, Gigante Sabato. And they have these skits take 45 seconds, and then it's, you know, excitement, and somebody throws something in the air, and then it's Telemundo, and then we're on to the next one. And then you go back to, like, just American regular English television. It's, like, calm, but it's exciting stuff. But it just seems like there's got to be an endpoint at which a thought has to take more than 15 seconds to develop or something like that. Now, I mean, forgive your Spanish, but it's exciting television. But it's frenetic.
If we had the opportunity to have the late Neil Postman join us here, I think it would be an interesting conversation. But we would want to talk to him not so much about communication for the sake of communication, or even meaning for the sake of meaning, but we want to talk to him about what we consider to be the greatest calling on earth, which is to teach and preach the Word of God, to communicate the gospel. And I think we'd have to say, Mr. Postman, we're thankful for your very insightful analysis. It actually helps us to understand what we're all about. It helps us to understand the mind of the age. It helps us to understand the challenge. But we're just going to tell you that because of our concern to see the gospel communicated in every way possible to everyone we can possibly reach, we're actually going to do our best to use every appropriate medium to get that done. And so without apology, I think we're going to have to go places and do things. We're going to have to learn skills, and we're going to have to be missiologically adaptable. Otherwise, what the world's going to know of us is that we are indeed antiquarians or cranks. I hope the heart work in this book and analysis leads us to want to be communicators of skill and of conviction in a world that desperately needs more than communication. They need the gospel. I want to thank you all for joining. I think this has been a worthy conversation. I think there may be no one more surprised than Neil Postman to have imagined that 25 years later, here a group of seminary folk will be sitting around discussing his book. But that, again, is a representation of the power of a book.
Yes.
We're not talking about an episode of the Beverly Hillbillies. But we're going to admit we do know what the Beverly Hillbillies was all about. Thank you for joining today. Thank you for joining the panel in this discussion.